Welcome to the fire.
Welcome to the fire, boys. My name is Parker McDonald.
And I'm Walter Lee, and we'll be your hosts on this episode of the Southern Collective Hunting Podcast. If you're a new hunter trying to learn the basics,
or you're a veteran woodsman just trying to get through your workday, there's always a place at our campfire for you.
Speaking of the fire, we would love it if you guys would join our growing Patreon community and be a part of the best and only digital deer camp south of Mason-Dixon Line.
Come on. If you'd like to learn more, click on the link in the show notes. But for now, Walt,
welcome to the fire.
Welcome back to another episode of the Southern Collective Hunting Podcast. I am joined by a man who is no stranger to a microphone, the man that is almost always on every one of these episodes whenever I start the intro off, largely because he doesn't allow me to record by myself anymore. He took those roles away because I just ramble and take us. I'm just kidding. He's never taken that away, but I think he's probably thought about it and he's probably thinking about it right now. Ladies and gentlemen, we have got an episode that I think you're going to really enjoy. It's not one of those sexy topics, but it's one of those topics that's really required. And it's one that is really listener Patreon driven. This is something that has been born between opportunity and a constant dialogue this time of year. We are talking to the CEO, Mike Costello, of Howl for Wildlife. And Parker, you said it best. What a nice guy.
What a nice guy. Yeah. Even when we were getting off the conversation, off the phone call a few minutes ago, just happy to be, you know, just like had that happy to be here look. And I do have to say, I think this is a record, Walter. It only took 55 seconds of recording this podcast for you to stop talking. So,
oh man. Yeah. You know what? You're right. That's I'm probably, people are going to feel like I shorted them.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know if they're going to feel that.
Everyone in the car collectively in that pause went, no, we're not.
I've got to tell you, Walter, there's a particular podcast. I'm not going to name it. Mm-hmm. But during turkey season, I try to listen to turkey podcasts, you know, and there's a particular podcast where one day I timed it and the host had talked for 36 minutes. Before somebody else ever talked on that podcast.
Oh my God.
He talked for 36 minutes. And there was like two other people on the episode, you know, like there was other people around. And so it could be worse. You know what I mean? Like,
yep.
Don't worry about it too much. But it is a constant thing that I'm learning is that while you say I am no stranger to the microphone, you like this microphone a lot.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. You know, I found that if I turn down my mic monitoring and I don't hear myself, I'm not quite as enamored by it. I think it's like the ADD squirrel thing. Like I hear myself, I'm like, oh, that was a good sentence. Let's see if you can do it again. But before we lose our entire audience, dude, I'm in full turkey.
Well, hold on. You just went away. My whole comment right there just kind of sounded douchey without some context. And I got to offer that context. We are constantly finding out, you and I, who have both owned our own platforms, mm-hmm, separately from each other. You know, we had co-hosts and stuff, but largely we were doing those things and hosting them. And now here we are doing the Southern Collective thing together. And so there's been like so many times when, even in this conversation with Mike, where I've had to learn to share the space. Yeah. Like there's somebody else who also is good at forming questions and also
it's so true,
really likes to talk, you know? And yeah. So it's always like this, like, hey, let me talk for 5 seconds, bruh.
Yeah.
I think we both have it.
Yo, all the time. If there was a dollar, for every time I go, and then I just hush, like I open my mouth for, I realize I'm on video right now, but you guys won't see that. But I open my mouth to say something and then I shut up because I'm like, you're dominating the space. You literally have asked 5 questions in a row. Shut the heck up. Parker can think for himself. You know, It's tough, man. But I do think that's kind of what makes us unique at the same time, is we're both, you know, actively trying to, you know, pursue a dialogue.
It's been fun getting used to it. It's also been fun having those one-on-one conversations that it's probably the reason why it works. Yeah. Is because of the one-on-one conversations that you and I have that would probably be funny if we could share them with the world. We should probably start recording those conversations.
Is that a new Maybe Patreon not. Benefit? Yeah.
Yeah, new Patreon.
Squirrel notes.
Speaking of Patreon.
Every Tuesday. Yeah. Come on, do it.
Speaking of Patreon,
mm-hmm.
Man, we got back from a heck of a great deer trip not too long ago, deer camp with our Patreon guys. Been editing a lot of video. I just put up the video from the last Patreon turkey hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I get to do that and relive those moments, I'm reminded of how grateful I am for that community. The community is awesome. These guys are, I feel like I talk about them every day. Yeah, I talk to these people every day. But I feel like every single day I'm telling people, like, y'all, this Patreon, these guys are just different. They're the best.
Well, you know, I talked to somebody the other day and they described Patreon as a group of our fans. And I was like, no. And they're like, yeah, but that's what they are. I was like, yeah, maybe, but they're not at the same time, right? Like, they were there for me when the birth of my son and sent me stuff, right? Just to say thanks, you know? And they actively participate in building a community that we think is important to have on the landscape. And they're taking new hunters. I mean, hell, Graybeard's taking kids on a hog hunt this upcoming month, you know? I mean, it's just like, it's so much more. It's this tight knit group of guys that take each other to go do new things, whether it's, you know, somebody volunteers to take you duck hunting or they take you scouting on one of the Patreon hunts. And it is, it's a group of guys that normally would be completely disconnected that find community in one space and like-minded individuals. And that conversation we talk about on the show, it is constantly rolling in the Polo and the Discord group. So if you're interested in going, we've got just a couple spots left for the Patreon hunt, by the way, the turkey hunt that's coming up next month. We have a couple spots available for that. But if you're interested in being plugged into a close, tight-knit, no BS group, this is where you want to go. It is amazing the amount of things you'll learn, the amount of things that we learn on a week-to-week, day-to-day basis. I love it, man. And I'm so remarkably grateful for each and every one of them.
Well, Walt, you know, speaking about turkey hunting, I have been putting the deer stuff away, getting out my turkey stuff, and I did not have to take out that old turkey vest this year because I took my turkey vest out of a brand new box, and I have been getting that thing, it's actually right here behind me, getting this M2 vest ready to go, and I've never felt like I needed to be creative to put my turkey stuff together, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But with this vest, I feel like I am like looking at different options, different ways to make that maybe even challenge the way that a typical turkey vest is structured so that it fits my needs. And that's the thing that I like about the M2 vest is that I can move stuff around. It's modular and modular is, like, it is so modular. When I say modular, I mean, like, it is completely customizable to you. You can, I mean, and just Tethered has a lot of attachments. Tethered has a lot of different options and call attachments and things like that. But because of the Molly, you and I were talking about this earlier, because of those Molly connections there, I mean, you pretty much have entire storehouses, Amazon storehouses of options that you can find to fit your needs, which is a really, really probably my favorite part about this vest.
Yeah, dude. No. And especially as a self-filmer, the ideas that you and I have had, not most people who listen to this aren't self-filmers, but it still reflects that diversity of opportunity there. We're coming up with new ways to carry our tripods to make it more efficient to where hopefully, you know, we can go further. It's not weighing on us quite like it did before. And man, I'm going to tell you, I've said this 100 times, that seat, I'm not even a big fan of a seat anymore, but that daggum tethered seat, dude, I cannot wait for you to try it out. Those different layers of foam, it makes it so customizable, so comfortable. And I think whenever you work with the, or whenever you find those companies that really find ways to make things more enjoyable, smoother, more comfortable, more efficient, whatever it is, you have to really grab onto it and run with it. And that's kind of one of the reasons why we work with Honeycomb Custom Calls. You know, he makes some of the easiest to run, best sounding turkey calls out there. And we've worked with him to design a call line that anybody should be able to use that require the least amount of air and make the widest array possible of turkey noises from just two mouth calls.
That's right. Yeah. That other call and the JB special.
Yeah.
I'll be honest with you. I will probably not have another diaphragm in my call wallet this year. I probably have them and then backups for them. Because what I have found is that, similar thing with this copper surface, pot call that I've got from Honeycomb. Like, I just don't think there's going to be a lot of scenarios where I can't walk into the woods with just those three calls and have a diversity of sounds that I can make. That's right. The important part about that. You need to have that diversity. These calls have it. So, man, I really would tell anybody, especially the new person, but even the veteran turkey hunter, to check out these calls from Honeycomb Custom Calls, because I do not think you will be disappointed.
And along the lines of smooth, efficient items, we recently recorded an episode with Jordan Barnes that'll come out in the near future. Dude is crazier than I'll get out chasing turkeys with a bow. But one of the things that you'll need if you want to chase a bow, chase a turkey, is a smooth, easy to draw bow. I know I botched that one up. It's okay. It was a great segue and then I ruined it. But I'm going to tell you something, dude. That Carbon Icon is the easiest to draw bow. I've said this since the beginning. I had the Bowtech prove to me that it was 65 pounds because it felt just like such a dream to draw back. So check out Bowtech if you're looking at a new bow. I know several new Patreon members have, several of the Patreon members have been buying them and raving about them in the group. I love working with companies who make it as easy to tune a bow as they do.
That's right. That's right. I unfortunately have severed the string on my brand new Bowtech bow that I got. I mean, dude, I was shooting freaking tacks with this Joker and feeling really confident. And about the time I put it away, the next time I was going to take it out was going to be on a deer hunt. I realized that a broadhead had cut the string somehow. But here's the thing that I'm not concerned about with the Bowtech, to what you're saying, is that I will be able to get it back to game ready quickly.
Yep.
Because the first time it took three arrows, you know what I mean? This will be a cakewalk. It's such a tunable bow. It's such an easy bow. If you have any knowledge about tuning a bow, you will love it. If you have no knowledge about tuning a bow, you can learn it this bow. And that's why I'm excited about it.
All right, dude. So we're under 15 minutes. This will be the shortest intro we've done in quite some time. Building on how quickly I segued, let's get everybody over to Mike. He's got a really important message, a really great organization that I think a lot of people in the group have been clamoring for, and they're going to enjoy hearing from him. He's just a stand-up guy, the nicest you can be, and hopefully he gets a turkey this spring and we can have him on to talk about that, because he's chomping at the bit.
That's right. I think I am really attracted to this episode with Mike because it's hard to keep up with every single issue that is going on in the hunting space when it comes to conservation, when it comes to our rights as hunters. It's hard to keep up. These guys are doing it for you and presenting the information in an easy way to consume and learn. And I'm interested for guys to hear that.
That's awesome, man. And I completely agree, especially as content creators working full-time jobs. It's really hard because we're trying to meet all our deadlines to get content out for you guys, recruit new episodes. And they're going to make it really easy for us with a syndication, a product syndication. They're going to record a podcast, send it to us. We're going to drop it on the audio waves for you guys as a bonus episode, not as one of the main four, as a bonus episode. And then you guys can go right to the call to action items and be plugged in with minimal amount of effort, but maximum efficiency, which is something we talk about in the deer woods. We don't talk enough about conservation. So I hope you guys really enjoy the episode. I did recording it. I'm probably going to really enjoy editing it, and hopefully it brings some joy to y'all's day.
Yeah, man. Let's get in this conversation with Mike.
About this time of year, the spirit of giving back And, you know, we've all had a 7-month deer season. We've had a blast. Well, maybe not all of us, but most of them in the South have had like a very long deer season. And we are left with a feeling of gratitude and a feeling of wanting to give back to sustain. But the reality is we've burned a lot of our PTO. We've burned a lot of our good graces from our wives and our families to be out there pursuing our obsession. And it leads us finding it difficult to find ways to plug in and still have that impact. And I think today you're going to be hearing from a guest that has the ability to give you guys the means and the ability to impact massive change with a minimal effort. It's a high efficiency kind of situation here. I'm really excited about it. And we're going to get to that in just a second. But I want y'all to get to know today's guest, Mike Costello. Dude, John Stallone connected us with you. We got to chat on the phone the other day, but for anybody who doesn't know who you are, why don't you kind of give everybody a little bit of a background to who you are and then what you, the organization you work for.
Yeah. I'll apologize first and foremost. I'm in California. So thank you for opening up the door to me to even be here. But yeah,
Southern guys everywhere just like turned it off.
Yeah, I know. We just lost the FBI. No, stay with us. Hang in there. It gets better, I think. So I've been in California all my life. Grew up the most outdoor stuff that I did. I did a lot of backpacking, a lot of like multi-day, 5-7 day backpacking trips with my dad as a kid, and I got bored just walking around in the woods, and so I learned to fly fish early. So my harvest from the land early as a teenager was largely like backcountry fly fishing, and I kind of dreamed about hunting a little bit, but just never got into it. So I finally, you know, did the adult onset hunter thing 7 years ago, and I hunt solo completely, which is kind of the opposite of your deer camp concept. But for me, it's getting out in the woods, and to me, it's like a puzzle. California hunting's not easy. I think just because our game populations are relatively low, and we've just got a lot of big mountain, big backcountry areas to go into. So to me, it's like this puzzle. It's this endless riddle. No matter how much information you pick up on a good day or a bad day, you cache that information away and you use it to then figure out the next step of the riddle. But the riddle you're never solved. Like, it's never completely finished. And I think that I think that's how it is, whether you're hunting, you know, blacktails or mule deer or black bear or whitetail, whether you're running food plots and just every year trying to make it better, figure it out to get that one buck in that's always across the road and won't come over your property, or whether you're hunting turkey. I think, you know, hunting is very much a mental and physical, and for some people, like spiritual game that's just always evolving. And in that regard, to me, hunting is intrinsically a human activity. Like, there hasn't been a culture on planet Earth that didn't go out, participate in nature, engage with the land and the habitat and the wildlife, and harvest from it. Like, that society doesn't exist that didn't do that. And so I'm involved with Howl for Wildlife. Kind of got involved 2 years ago when there was a second attempt by the Humane Society of the U.S., HSUS. I call them part of the anti-hunting industry. I don't call them animal rights advocates because I don't think they really advocate.
That's great.
They don't really advocate for animal rights. They identify a specific species that they want to put on a pedestal at the cost of a lot of other species and at the cost of human participation in nature. And so HSUS was on their second round of trying to take bear hunting away from Californians on the threat, the idea that there was not enough bears in California, that they were threatened by wildfire and drought and all these things. And actually, from a biologist perspective, the wildfires benefit the black bears, just with successional habitat and regrowth and whatnot. We have lots of black bears in California. Many people see them more than they see deer. But at that time, the issue was in front of the commission. And we'll get into the weeds here on like where an issue sits and who the decision makers are and how we as hunters can be fast and effective in engaging those people. But the issue was at the commission level, and the commission's charter is really to support sustainable hunting. They're there to protect the wildlife in terms of make sure that the critters are successful. But they're also there to protect, you know, hunting and use hunting as a tool for management. And this commission didn't used to see a lot of hunters. They saw a lot of the crazy cat ladies that would show up and they'd make the same pitch every time that they're in there, you know, stop hunting. I love the furry critters. You know, they make their character assassination mm-hmm. of what their typical hunter is. And then they sit down and the hunters weren't present. Like, we weren't there. And we realized that we have to show up. Like, we have to show up, whether it's an email or a phone call or in person. And at that time, COVID was in full swing in California. And so in-person meetings weren't happening. A lot of people had more free time on their hands. In-person work wasn't happening. So all of a sudden, we as a community could go in. We could attend these Zoom calls in mass. And we got hundreds, literally hundreds of hunters that hadn't participated in the process before to be in person in these Zoom calls with these commission meetings. And we completely, like, we surprised ourselves and we surprised the commission. The commission was really happy to have us there. They really liked hearing the stories and the values that mm-hmm. we brought about why we bear hunt, what we do with the meat, that we do use the meat, we do use the fat, like we feed our families, we feed our friends. You know, that the bear hunt is not just jump out of the truck and, you know, shoot stuff. It's a physical and mental endeavor that requires effort. And so the commission heard that from us as a community for the first time, really in ages, and it really resonated and it worked. And we got that petition from the HSUS defeated, you know, in a unanimous vote from the commissioners in California. And so, you know, California is frequently seen as like the state that all the anti-hunting regulations flow from.
Yeah.
And so we realized that we figured out that we kind of tapped a vein on the hunter advocacy and hunter engagement working. We weren't the ones there with pitchforks and screaming and, you know, wild statements. And it was actually turned out to be the anti-hunters that were making all of the crazy lies, the allegations that they would make were totally unfounded.
Surprising.
Yeah. What's really become clear is that, like, when you look at data of hunting, you look at stories of hunting, you look at the why of why people go out and hunt, you look at the conservation systems of how they work, like the human side of hunting and the data side of hunting and the wildlife success side of hunting, they all point to hunting is good for wildlife. Especially, yeah. And it's modern hunting. Whereas the anti-hunters, they anchor on, you know, stories of 100 years ago where there was mm-hmm. market hunting that did strip a lot of animals off the landscape. You know, there was poisoning of wolves. There was poisoning of predators. You know, there's things being done 60, 80, 120, 200 years ago that are not today's version of hunting. It's not what the three of us espouse and practice and want to see, but they have to hang on to those ancient stories of like humans being bad, to make their stories work. And Howl's, the whole mission of Howl, we have two purposes at Howl. One is to make it super easy and effective for you guys, anybody who's listening, to jump on, look at the action center, see what the problems of the day are, see what the threats or opportunities of the day are that look to either take down hunting opportunity or flip conservation on its head, or maybe even put in place like protections for hunting as a right. You look at the action center, you can see it, and you can click on a thing, and literally within like a minute or two, you can have your message sent, and you can craft your own message, or you can use one that we've got there. You can have your message sent to the decision makers that have that issue in their hands at that time. Like, you don't email your senators when the commission has it. You don't email the commission mm-hmm. when the Senate has it. You know, so that's the part that we help navigate, is we make sure that the messages are going to the right place. But the other thing that Howl's building out is mechanisms and ways to communicate to the non-hunters. Because I think a lot of times we as a community, we get upset with, you know, that suburban, urban non-hunter who votes a certain way against us because they don't understand what it is that we're doing. Those people just vote. Like, they're not, we can't obligate them to know what we're doing if we don't tell them what we're doing. You know, like they don't, mm-hmm. they're just going about their lives. They're busy. They got two jobs. They got kids. They got debt. They got car payments. They got, you know, soccer games and all that stuff that they've got their lives stacked up with. If hunting's not part of it, they're going to be very quickly swayed. They're going to make a 3-second decision at some point that's influenced by probably a picture and a headline. Mm-hmm. And we, like as a hunting community, because we like to stay kind of within our, we like to stay in our tent, you know, we like to sit in our blind. We don't want to go out. Like we don't bring the world into our blind. We don't bring the world into our tent. We go to our tent or our blind to be away from the world. And so we haven't been feeding our pictures and our headlines into the non-hunting community the way that the anti-hunting industry has literally for the last 40 years. Like they've redefined words and they've redefined language in a way that paints modern conservation-based hunting in a bad way. And so we're building out stories and communication tools to put in front of that non-hunter who we actually just need to love a little more. We don't need to recruit them. R3, I think, is dead. You know, the recruit, retain, reactivate. People are going to hunt or they're mm-hmm. not. There's the fourth R that really is the valuable. It's the relatability. Like, do they relate to us? They don't become us, but do they relate to hunting and why it's important? Or is it relevant? Like, do they see, oh, I don't hunt, but I see why it's relevant to wildlife success. And so those are the two things that Howl's doing. Building advocacy systems and tools for hunters or anybody else that wants to value wildlife management with hunting at the core. Or communicating to those that aren't about why it's important to support and embrace hunting as conservation's number one, you know, mechanism.
It's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah.
a lot of, we could probably just end the podcast now. I feel like you gave a really good, a really good description of what Howl does. And I was
wildlife.org.
Yeah.
In the show notes.
I think Mike, you have a very unique perspective and you have a perspective that really kind of applies here because being from California, I'm from Texas originally, mm-hmm. live in Alabama now. Most of my life has been around the South, mm-hmm. and around rednecks and around people who hunt. And like, it's just in nowhere have I ever, I've never been anywhere that hunting was just like unheard of, you know,
right.
or people didn't have an uncle who hunts or something like that. Now, I've never been to California. Mm-hmm. I don't know a whole lot of people from California. Mm-hmm. But what I've been told of California is that it is not a regular thing to hunt. Like there's a lot of people who don't hunt. I've also yep. been told things like what you think about California is different than big California. There's a lot of rednecks. There's a lot of hunters. There's a lot of people who live that lifestyle and they're maybe not shown as the demographic of California.
Yeah.
So you as an adult onset hunter, you grew up, I'm guessing in California, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Suburban South Orange County, like high school is Orange County. Go to, you know, junior year and senior year of high school, I was at the beach every day like that.
You have the unique perspective that you have is that you started this and with an idea of what the Americans who are the furthest away mm-hmm. from being exposed to hunting. And you've kind of exemplified what it is that you're talking about in the hardest place probably to do it.
Culturally. So you're not supported.
Yeah.
Like you're very, very much on my own. And that may be one reason I hunt alone is I didn't have an immediate community that was like lifting me up in the hunting space. And so Yeah, I don't know if I would have hunted. You know, I definitely didn't grow up in it. I think about people talk about how hard it is to hunt, and I think, you know, 7 years in, 30 days a year, you know, I've got a couple hundred days on the field now. People that have grown up in hunting, they get those 200 days in the field, you know, before they're 15, and they just soak up and absorb, you know, the culture, the tactics, the strategies, the woodsmanship. You know, there's so much that you absorb when you're brought up in the community of hunting that is just natural. Like you just said, like you can't imagine not being in a community where people don't hunt.
What was the thing for you that got you either interested or started in it?
I wanted to deer hunt when I was a kid. You know, my dad and I, we went out and walked in the woods one time for like 5 hours. You know, I had a rifle in my hands. It was a rifle walk. We didn't see anything. Like, I think he just, it wasn't his thing. And we didn't have, you know, again, we lived in suburban, you know, East Bay area, you know, 30 miles from San Francisco, or we lived, you know, between San Diego and LA. Like, there just wasn't a community there. My dad didn't really hunt. He hunted as a kid some. He did some deer hunting as a kid. But again, we weren't steeped in it, and we weren't close to it. And so I'm sure now that I look back, you know, the magic of Facebook, I can see guys I went to high school with. I'm like, I bet he hunted. Like, you know, they had their family trip. Like, their family trip was they'd go to Montana for 2 weeks and, you know, in the fall, and we would go skiing. Like, people would go do their family trip. And I realized there probably were some people that were sitting next to me in class that hunted. But because it just wasn't the norm, like, they didn't come back and talk about it because they probably didn't know if they had it. There's who would they talk to about it, you know? So is it harder there?
Is it harder to hunt, like to get a license, to get a you know,
no
hunter safety well, education? Like,
no, you do online. You can do online hunter safety. It's free. I think it's a free course online, or maybe it's $25. You know, licenses, everything's more expensive here, I think. You know, a license, you know, your basic package of deer license, you know, of license, first deer tag, upland game stamp, you know, waterfowl stamp. You know, you're looking at $200 pretty quick, which I think is significantly more than your you know, your license, your small game, your four doe and one buck tag or whatever you guys can get out there. But people are, you know, people drop $200, you know, on all kinds of stuff, you know, and so if people
that could be more of a representation of the value of a dollar in California versus in Alabama. You know what I mean? I know.
Yeah, exactly. It is
very different.
Yeah.
I just think I like the reason I like what you do with Hal. I'm proving your point right now. I believe everything I've heard about hunting in California just because of what maybe two people have said about California.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And you offer this unique perspective of a non-hunter. You understand, just by hearing you talk, the things that you said, you understand kind of the mindset of it is not inherently against hunting.
Right.
Because how could it be? It's kind of like human nature, as you said. Mm-hmm. Society has been doing it forever.
Yeah.
But you also understand that it's not necessarily that they hate hunters or hate the idea of what we know as hunting.
Mm-hmm.
I hate the idea of what other people portray as hunting. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
how can
we,
I
we all
them
do
to
and
like
that's
it?
That's what's so wild is, you know, what's used to market against hunting. Like, we are like, well, that's insane. That's gross. Like, that's repulsive. I'd vote against that too, but I know that that's not what it is.
What are some things that you have done that you felt like have kind of bridged that gap? You know what I'm saying? To help, like, specific examples of helping people who maybe didn't understand.
Yeah. So I started running trail cams early. I realized after my first season of deer hunting, I saw zero deer. It wasn't until like the last day, and this is like 20 days in the mountains, it wasn't until like the last day that I actually found this area where I was seeing fresh scat, fresh sign. I'm like, oh, it's the last day I found where the deer were yesterday. Like, I actually found a spot. So I was like, okay.
You just described Walt season every year.
No deer until the last day. And lots of turds, so lots of deer turds.
I was wondering if you're going to make that big.
And so I put up some trail cameras the next year. And lo and behold, I'm like, oh my gosh, like there's bucks in here. You know, I was in the right spot. And so these trail cameras are giving me this amazing proof of life. And I'm just like, I'm giddy about it. Like, this is me. And I'm not even seeing them in person. I'm just giddy about the fact that the trail cameras are showing me that there's deer in this area. So I started sharing this stuff onto, you know, Instagram and in the Facebook groups and stuff. But Instagram is where, you know, Facebook groups is very pre-selected. Of course, it's all hunters. Instagram is my personal like stuff, like the dogs, the kids, you know, the vacation deer and bear on my trail cameras. And so there was this, I wouldn't call it, there was just this easy introduction to my social circle that I was starting to pursue these animals. And so most of my friends before I started sharing stuff, we're non-hunters. And this is all new for them and me, like Mike hunting, Mike looking for animals in the woods is new. And so they kind of got used to that and they became fascinated. Like, who doesn't like a picture of a bear, like in the woods? Who doesn't like a picture of a buck in the woods or a fawn, you know, that's 2 weeks old? Like, all of this stuff is fascinating. And so I think they saw me evolving as a hunter while I was also showing them my interest in just wildlife in general. And those two things came together. Like, okay, Mike is working really hard. This is not a simple, just jump in the truck, throw a six pack of beer out in the back and like go shoot something. There's this mental aspect to it. There's an effort aspect to it. It's actually really complicated and not easy. And so that kind of built up to where when I did finally get my first harvest, which was a bear with a bow, like my first animal was a bear with archery equipment, you know, like 25 yards, 4 years in, people like, oh my God, like people that didn't hunt and probably haven't, you know, don't hunt, won't hunt, et cetera, were still like, wow, that's amazing. You know? And so I think the biggest part of it was me sharing the full breadth of the story. Not just silent and then look at this dead bear. Like, it was, they saw the whole journey. Mm-hmm. And I've had several non-hunters reach out and comment and just say, like, I'm not a hunter and I'm probably, you know, they're probably admittedly like way, like we're on different sides of the spectrum, maybe politically, socially in a lot of ways, but they're like, what you're doing, like, you've shown me that there is actually a side to this that I had no idea existed. Like there's a cerebral mental side to what you're doing. And I know that you value wildlife in general. And this is kind of broken it's broken some things down for me in a way that I didn't know existed. And hang on. That's why I think it's critical that we use our equivalent of the cave drawing, that we use our social media. Like, anti-hunters don't want us to use social media. They want us to think that every time we post something, we're doing something wrong. When really we need to use the social media. We need to push the story of our hunt, of our planning, of our failures, all of it, not just the grip and grins, but we need to push those things into our personal circles and into social media so that people see that whole thing and like, okay, because that's where the stories of that we tell about hunting are where we make the bridge to the non-hunters that say, mm-hmm. okay, I get it. There's more here than I knew.
It's funny. I grew up surrounded by hunters. The idea of a non-hunter was a cultural shock to me. Like, I didn't know that they existed until literally I had a woman walking her dog through the woods. And I was like, hey, like, you know, there's people out here hunting. You need to be wearing Blaze Orange. And she looked at me dead in the face and goes, I could care less if you lost the right to hunt and fish. I'm like, okay, first off, I'm just trying to keep you safe, guy. Like,
wow.
Good morning. Nice to see you. Don't know who you are. You know, like, Yeah, like so, like,
well,
you
see,
know,
that's not just trying a to non-hunter. She's like, she's in the position of anti-hunter.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. Actually, you're absolutely right. But that was still my first encounter with like any spectrum of Saturday mornings or for hunting, Sunday mornings or for hunting. Like, well, not Sunday mornings, yeah. Sunday afternoons. Sorry, Parker. And so, you know, it was always a bit of a culture shock. Then I moved to Tallahassee with my wife. And all of her friends are like either non-hunter or like that woman, yeah, I described, right? Like just completely, I wouldn't say any of them were advocates against us, but they enjoyed the parks that the Pittman Robertson Land Trust Fund, absolutely, put on the landscape. And they enjoyed the wildlife that they got to see there. And it was so funny to me because what you described is so, like, I experienced it so viscerally, yep, myself. These people went from, I had vegetarians who would hear Elena talk about how lean venison was and they would eat it and then it didn't mess with their stomachs, like, mm-hmm, like all the other meats that they had cut out. And these are dancers, these are high performance, mm-hmm, individuals. And they started coming to the party saying, "Hey, do you have any venison? Hey, do you have any venison?" And so the trepidation fades and suddenly they're starting to be, you know, really excited about eating it and consuming it, which is part of the story, yeah, you're talking about. And then I'd have people reach out on Facebook and say, "I really wish you'd taken a picture of it instead of shooting it, but I could see how much you enjoyed, yeah, that. And I'm proud, yeah, for you," right? That isn't that she would prefer one thing, but she's still, you know, having fun for it. And so what you say about telling the story,
if it's mm-hmm, a value to you, and that's, then it's right, like, and if they like you and respect you and all the other areas of life, if it's a value of yours, then they're less likely to try to take it away from you.
That's right. That's
and
right.
The, and one deer, recognize... one backstrap in Walter's house is of high value. You might only get one or two of them a year. A
rare,
you know what I mean?
Rare occurrence.
Some bucks he kills might only have one good backstrap on them.
I'll send you an episode that makes that joke make even more fun. I mean, that's a good one. That's a zinger. I shot a deer that had been ran over by a car in a past life, and so there wasn't much meat left on that thing.
No.
So
why is this important though? Like out west, it seems like Colorado has this major issue right now. California, we've lost the opportunity to hunt with hounds. Trapping's been taken away. Bobcats are on hold right now. Mountain lions we can't hunt. Like we lost a lot of stuff, mostly 15 to 30 years ago. Washington State's got issues. Colorado, I mentioned, has got issues. So I think the cultural divide that I think people can easily jump to is like, this is a Western States issue. I don't know. Do you guys get that or?
Okay. Yeah.
Florida,
yeah, it's always
does
Oregon. It's always New Hampshire. It's always feels like it's like some distant, far foreign country that doesn't, yeah, impact us.
I'll, yeah, tell you one that does impact us directly is the Florida black bears. Not I say us, I don't live in Florida, but I have been to Florida and my in-laws are in Florida. My friends are in Florida and there are so many black bears in Florida.
Is that wild?
And you can't hunt them. There is literally no season to hunt them. And the people
here have just kind of like let that go. Like the hunters, mm-hmm, have like, just, we're never getting that back. And they're probably not wrong. Like there, it is probably going to be harder to get it back. But it's like this like venomous relationship where like hunters who used to hunt bear are pissed, sure, and they don't want to tell their story on social media. Like you and I just, right, talked about, they want to keep it as close to the vest as humanly possible because the last time they shared that stuff and exposed themselves, they had that stuff taken, right, away from them.
Right.
And it was a multi-million-dollar media effort. Like they photoshopped photos of hunters killing young, yeah, bears. Like they went all out to make us look bad. And there was no representation for it, really.
Yeah. And that's what they being the anti-hunting industry, that's what they do. And I call it an industry because they fundraise, you know, American SPCA sells puppy calendars, and then they turn around and they put money into legal and political battles that take away hunting rights. Like they fundraise, they'll fundraise nationally and then pull money in, celebrities in, you know, all kinds of resources into a local battle. That issue in Florida when bear hunting was taking away, it probably wasn't homegrown. Like, it wasn't the local anti-hunting chapter. Like, it was probably funded and organized by political and legal strategists that are working nationally or globally. And that's what's so crazy, is they do this and they come in, and then by the time we as a community get wind of it, it's like, whew, like we're way behind. And then hunters, again, we go back, you know, we go back into our tent, we go back into our blind, we hunt solo. I hunt California. Why do I care? Like, historically, that's been the reality, but I think there's an awakening. I really believe that we as a group, as a community, are starting to realize that when we didn't protect running hounds, when we didn't protect trapping, you know, those that don't run hounds don't understand it. Those that don't trap don't understand it. When we let go of things and didn't support and protect things that we don't understand or that we aren't personally involved in, we gave up something that we'll never get back, or very hard to get back. And it moves the attack closer to us. You know, that just incrementally, they're just getting closer and closer to whatever it is that we love. And so that's my call, you know, to your community, is the anti-hunting orgs, they place people. Like, there's two HSUS people on the payroll in Arizona. Arizona's a great state for hunting. Like, they've got great game management, they've got phenomenal opportunities. There's two HSUS people in Arizona that are on their salaried with the intent of moving the needle against Arizona hunting opportunity. Like, they didn't just grow up there with this thing. They're planted. They're like strategists, like mercenaries, you know, and this is where we need to come together.
Well-funded.
This is where we need to come together and acknowledge that and then figure out how to respond.
With Hal, do you, there are conservation issues like you just referred to, right? Like the anti-hunting industry against the hunting community, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's also these internal issues that are, you know, like you mentioned, like hounds, running hounds. There are great cases for running hounds. There's also great cases against running hounds, you know, just from a conservation standpoint or whatever. There are plenty of laws or regulations throughout the United States that are, you know, that maybe need to be in place. Maybe you don't need to. So my question is, does Hal cover that scope of things, or is it specifically aimed towards what you've more been referring to, which is kind of the against the hunting industry?
Yeah, I think I can answer that.
There's not a wrong answer. Our
view of where conservation, wildlife management, hunting decisions should be made is that they should be made at the commission level. Most states, if not all states, have your Department of Natural Resources, your Fish and Game Commission, your Department of Wildlife, Fish and Wildlife. And usually there's a commission, which is they're appointed either by county, you know, groups of counties, or the governor appoints them. You know, they're appointed, then they're approved. They do regulatory structure, and then there's the department that executes the structure. That's where the wardens are. That's where the tags are sold. And so our view is that's the healthiest place for decisions to be made, as long as, and they need to be informed by data and science. And so, you know, I'm not going to say, oh yeah, we should, you know, let's use California and black bears as an example. You know, we want spring bear. We want, to be able to run hounds. We want to bait. I'll throw baiting in. Okay. Should baiting be allowed in all of California's bear zones? Probably not, because you're going to have, you know, if you're an hour from San Francisco, people are walking their dogs and all that, then the dogs are getting in the base. Like, should you be able to bait in Northern California, where you're right across from the Oregon border and you're a 3-hour hike from anything? sure, who cares? Like, let's bait in the wilderness. But that decision should be made at the commission level as a method of take. They're going to decide what, and they modulate. We need more bears harvested. Let's increase the methods of take. Let's add a spring season. Let's run hounds. If we need to take more bears off the landscape from a management perspective, let's allow hound hunting in that area because it's the most effective. And so I don't just say all methods of take everywhere all the time because that's not practical, but the decision to modulate or adjust methods of take and the season structure and the tag structure and how many animals are coming off across all species should be vested with that commission. And the other reason is because we will often not like what the commission says or does. Like there's always gonna be somebody in the community that's like, that's not right. The commission structure kind of ebbs and flows. Like if they're appointed by the governor, well, you get a new governor every 4 to 8 years, right? And so the commission structure can kind of ebb and flow, and the commission makes its decisions very slowly, but they can reverse their decisions very easily. Whereas if it's a ballot box initiative or legislation, those decisions happen fast and they're not based on data and they're almost impossible to reverse. So like if we move, and most decisions related to wildlife management have been in the commission in level in the last, you know, if you go back 20, 30 years, but where we're losing the battle is when these issues get pushed to a ballot box item or a legislative item. Because then it's an emotional decision or it's a political decision. Mm-hmm. So it could, at that point, it can be funding. Like somebody's going to write me a check for $100,000. Sure, I'll vote this way. And so you get into politics and emotions making decisions for wildlife instead of actual data and science.
That is a great way to segue into what I was going to ask to follow that up is...
Softballs.
When somebody yeah. supports HAL, I know with a lot of different conservation organizations and similar things, honestly, mm-hmm. when you support one group, you're kind of making a political choice because they mm-hmm. have leanings, right? Does mm-hmm. that make sense? Yeah. I don't want to make the conversation political. I'm not going towards that. Mm-hmm. But when somebody supports HAL or becomes a part of what you guys have going yeah. on. Is that even a thing, or is it going to be strictly based on the data and the wildlife?
Yeah, we want the decision to be made based on data and at the commission level. And we know that we're not always going to agree with those, but that's where, like, if the department comes out and says, you know, we ran this 5-year study, this longitudinal study in this zone for 5 years, and it tells us that this critter needs to be put on hold. Like hunting this critter needs to be put on hold for these reasons for, you know, 2 seasons. Like, yeah, personally, I'd say, that sucks. I like hunting that critter. But at Howell's perspective, like that's the best and right decision because it's better than it going to the legislature. It's better than somebody in LA, you know, somebody, you know, 400 miles away voting on it. And so we think that that's where the argument, that's where the debate, that's where the science and the sausage making should happen is at that level.
Yeah.
You mentioned that people choose the conservation orgs that they're going to support. And, they kind of like, they throw down their $35 or $50 for membership, and there's some identity to it. Like I support and go to the NWTF dinner. It's the weekend before, you know, the Deer Association dinner. I don't go to that one. I go to the turkey dinner, not the deer dinner, you know? And so there's identity. People build up an identity with those things. And I think that's awesome. I think all the species specific orgs, they do what they do really well. Like RMEF does phenomenal work advocating for elk, creating, preserving, supporting, building up elk habitat, doing science and relocations to expand elk herds into former native range. They do phenomenal stuff. And I like to pick on them because they're one of the best at what they do, but they don't do advocacy very much. Like when the bear population in California is growing and elk calves are being killed by bears in northeastern California, and those bears are not huntable because of the way our zones are set up. And then there's a threat about taking bear hunting away. Personally, I was frustrated about how Army F didn't get involved in that fight. Like hard. I would have thought that the Mule Deer Association and Army F and California Deer Association, I would have thought that they would have rallied hard and like, no, we're going to preserve bear hunting. But that's not their lane. Like they're not bear hunting advocates. They are elk advocates and deer advocates. And NWTF is a turkey advocate and pheasants and quail forever, et cetera. So what Howell realized and what we realize is that nobody's doing this space of like, we'll talk to all of those orgs. We want to talk to members of all of those orgs about this advocacy thing, because there needs to be a place that stitches everybody together with one common goal. And that is preserve conservation, wildlife management, and hunting as the core for both. That's what's needed. And so, I'll talk to, the long range rifle hunting group tomorrow and the bow hunting, the trad bow group the next day. Like, I don't care. Like, you all do what you do and you're awesome at it. The trad bow people will fight tooth and nail with the long range rifle group as to which is better. I don't care. Like, they both take skills. They both take effort. They're both going to have a different tag and season structure attached to them. So, have at it. But at the end of the day, we need to make sure that hunting and across all species that are sustainable is supported regardless of what method of take or what critter you're going after.
Yeah, I was absolutely irate when I realized the lack of involvement, building on what you said a minute ago about REMEF, the lack of involvement from a variety of conservation groups when the bear hunt in Florida was under attack. And that was a real big blow to my desire to be involved with a lot of those agencies. Largely because of, and I hear what you're saying, and this is what I was told from a lot of them, is, well, this isn't our lane. Like, bear hunting isn't our lane. And the crux of the problem was they were saying, well, your management plan doesn't include bear hunting. And so if your management plan doesn't include bear hunting explicitly, then why is there a bear hunt? Okay. That logic, if not countered immediately, could be extrapolated very quickly to a lot of other management plans, and it creates an avenue in which to attack the logic surrounding a lot of our management plans. And so my whole argument on that is this is not an attack on bear hunting. This is an attack on the commission's ability, like you said, to decide what and how to manage the resource. And it was a direct assault on that. And it wasn't lost in the courts. The governor pulled the plug because of the political pressure. There was not enough support for it. And to me, if you're wanting to be an advocate, save the habitat, save the hunt, and I'm not like dogging NWTF directly here, but as in like I'm life jaded. But if your whole thing is save the habitat, save the hunt, and you don't save the mechanism that saves the habitat, you're not doing any better. Okay, so you preserved a piece of property. Right. That's great. But if we don't have the means in which to manage it on our own, that's just as big an affront on what we do.
Yeah. Yeah. If you don't maintain the ability for trapping to take some raccoons off the back 20 acres, your turkey numbers are going to go down. Like if you don't allow those mechanisms to be in place for those that want to do it, then it's going to be harder to have the other species in balance as well. I think the attacks on hunting are, I'd say that they're ratcheted up heavier and more acutely now than they were, say, 20 years ago. Like 20 years ago, it was probably just California. Now they're everywhere in one shape or another. And I think, we all have had the NGOs that are there. They've been doing a good job for a long time. Focus on habitat, focus on the critters that they are, that they support and protect and whatnot. And that's been good enough. now we're realizing that they're good at what they do, but we need to know that we have the ability to work. We need to work as a community, as one. We're not just hunters of species and states with a method of take that we focus on. We need to all be banded together. And that mimics what the anti-hunters are doing. Like, that's what they do. You know, Coyote Project, Center for Biological Diversity, HSUS, they all pool funds and work together, and they all have their lane. I'm sure one of them will argue that it's better at this than the other, but ultimately they work together on things. And so we need to be able to do the same thing. That's the key. That's what Howl is really about. I think that there are, I don't want to project what some of the threats might be in the Southeast and in the East and the Midwest that are not, bear hunting in Florida. Is it going to come back or not? I know what I was going to get to. Why do we bear hunt? Some people will say, well, we bear hunt, we'll justify it. We justify a lot of hunting. Well, it protects the deer, or we bear hunt to protect, these other species, or to, because they strip trees, in the Northwest, they strip trees and they kill forests.
You said a great one a while ago, the raccoons. We trap raccoons and kill them.
Yeah.
Kill everyone we see because they eat turkeys.
Yeah.
They eat turkey eggs.
Are there other reasons to trap them though? The fur? We like the fur. I don't know if we eat raccoons or not. Do we eat raccoons?
They make a fine stew.
Raccoons stew. But at the end of the day, when we justify why we hunt something with some other outcome, as soon as we move the argument from hunting that critter to the value of the outcome, and then the anti-hunters say, well, we can get to that outcome some other way, or that outcome's not needed. I like to boil it down to, we hunt because we're human. Like, full stop. Mm-hmm. That's why we hunt. And the systems, and you go back to every society, not everybody in every clan, family, tribe, village, whatever you want to call the community group, whatever word you want to attach to that community group, not everyone hunted, usually. A percentage of the stakeholders in that community went out and hunted and brought stuff back. Other people did other things in that community. And so we, as a community of North Americans, we don't all hunt, and that's okay. But we need to preserve the right to hunt because we're human. And so conservation, we say we hunt, what we do supports conservation. It's kind of a two-way street. Conservation supports what we do. Like, if we hunted and we didn't have the conservation mechanisms that put funding back into biology, put funding back into habitat, curate a regulated system, then we probably would be where we were 150 years ago with a lot of animals on decline. So the system around conservation, I think, was created to harness the fact that people are going to go hunt no matter what. Like, people are going to want to go hunt. They're going to pay for the opportunity. And so knowing that that is a human, intrinsically human, thing to do and value, the system, like, we hunt to support conservation. Conservation exists to support wildlife. Wildlife are there to support hunting. Like, it's an economically and ecologically sustainable system that works. And I want to boil it down to where I don't have to justify my bear hunting for some other reason other than I'm a human being. I want to go out and go through the process. It's not the killing of the animal that's the thing. It's the process of getting to that. And then it's what happens after I take that animal. I take that animal, I've got, I'm backpacking it out. I got, 120 pounds of meat and fat. I got to backpack out. I'm happy to do it. I'm going to get it home. I'm going to process it. That fat and that meat's going to be part of our household consumption for the next, months to year. That justifies it in itself. Now, the question is my bear hunt sustainable? Am I leaving enough bears on the landscape every year to continue with that population? And if the department says yes, then I should be allowed to bear hunt. It just comes down to that. So if it's sustainable, if the critters are abundant, then, and it's sustainable, then hunting should be the mechanism that's used to maintain that ecosystem.
You got my vote.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you hit the nail on the head, especially if you look at the history and the programming that you kind of touched on at the beginning. You know, there was the market hunting, there was the mass clear cutting, there was the endangerment of entire ecosystems at one point in time. And it was hunters that looked at that. It was hunters that looked at that and went, "Ooh, this is not a good thing." And we did the best marketing we could at that time, which was as many animals as humanly possible and as many trees, mature trees as humanly possible. This is healthy ecosystems. And in that moment, that was the energy we needed to go towards. But the pendulum swings with time, and we haven't done a great job of turning the nose of the ship away from, listen, we've learned more. We need prairies, we need open areas, we need thick areas, we need to not have as many animals as possible, because we can very quickly exceed what the tipping point is, right? And we can introduce a lot of issues that way. And I think I'm really happy to see the two-prong approach that you guys take, which is, one, give me an easy way of annoying the crap out of the person I need to, because I'm gonna tell everybody here right now, one of my best friends in college was a staffer for an elected official. And he told me when we were fighting one bill in Georgia, he said, the number one thing you can do is pick up the phone and call somebody, because I have to answer that damn thing. And it's me that has to answer all the phone calls. And then I'm stuck here going, yes, I understand. Yes, I understand. No, we do understand. I will make sure. And then when I hang up the phone, there's another and another.
It goes
and another
on the tally sheet. Said, at the end of the day, I had 17 calls about this. I had three on this and one on this and five on that. Well, and they're like, the elected is like, well, what was that 17 on? I need to know about that.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, the politicians, as much as we don't like them, or as much as we like to not like them, the politicians, they bend with the wind. Like, they bend with the wind.
Absolutely.
Like, when it comes down to it. And so, like, Washington State, I'll go on the record saying that the commission that's been seated there, three or four of those commissioners came into that commission with a hard bias against hunting, and they were put in place by governor who thinks politically that's the right thing to do. And there were senators that approved them who thought politically that's the right thing to do. So I'm not going to be able to change the fact that those commissioners are anti-hunting. But if in Washington we can get the political winds being like the non-hunting public to think, oh, maybe hunting's better than I've been told by the antis, then those senators are going to start to ensure that the commissioners are less anti-hunting. And there's going to be a governor who, the governor's politics may not change on anything else, but that governor will be more likely to seat people that are more balanced and not and a little more centered and moderate. So the political winds will move, but like you said, you pick up the phone and call, or you send an authentic email, which the Howl website works for. It works.
Yeah, and he said there were on several occasions where the gentleman he worked for, I'm not going to mention his name, but the gentleman he worked for would be like, they didn't come in and look at the tally sheet so much as he specifically would come in and say, what's the vibe? Which way are we going on this? And he said the staffers who've been answering that phone call all day, they would go, that's the direction we're going on this. And their logic on it was, if 100 people pick up the phone and call me to tell me they're irate or they don't support something, that matters a hell of a lot more than whatever our inbox over there says. Not that it was discounted, right? Not that it isn't a good measure, but for that staffing crew, it was basically, hey, if there are people calling and taking time out of their day, they're not the minority. Yeah. They're speaking for a larger group of people. So I think both are important. I think blowing up both avenues are very important, and you've made it very easy to do both.
Yeah. Yeah, there is a call function. Some of the actions that we put up on the Howl Action Center, it actually presents you a script and you hit, it has an auto dialer to where you just tap it. So if you're on your phone, you just tap it and it will dial, and then it will bring you to the next one and it'll dial and it'll bring you to the next one. It puts the script up and you just read the script to them. And, you know, and so it makes it super, like, you don't have to go look, who's my elected? How do I call them? It just boom, boom, boom. And you're right. It's your voice talking to their voicemail or a human being on the other end. And it's so effective. This is an arena. I use a football analogy, or a Roman gladiator analogy. As a community, for too long we've been sitting outside at the barbecue, at the tailgate party, drinking beer, complaining about the refs while the game was going on inside the arena. And the anti-hunting industry was running the field and we weren't even there. And so we don't have to like the arena that these issues are decided in, but we do have to step onto the field. Like we don't have to like it. We don't have to like the refs. We don't have to like the rules. But if we don't go into the arena and at least like try to move the ball, we will lose. Like that's it. And we can't blame anybody else other than ourselves because the gates were open. like the gates are open. We can go in and step onto that field. And what's amazing is that because we haven't been really actively engaged as a community, as a team to win those games, to win in that arena, when we do step in there, it surprises the heck out of people with how effective we can be. Like it really blows people away with how effective we can be. And that's why I'm optimistic about the issue in Colorado this year, why I'm optimistic about even what's going on in Washington, and why I'm optimistic about when there's issues, Florida has its right to hunt and fish constitutional amendment. I hope that comes back around because I think we as a community can really leverage voices nationally and funding nationally to help get that over the line when it comes back around. So I think there's a lot we can do.
That's awesome, man. So Parker, do you have any closing thoughts before?
Man,
I have just a couple.
The only thing that I was going to ask is how do people get like involved? Is there a membership? How do people get involved?
Yeah.
Is there a membership? Is there levels to this thing? Like what's the,
yeah, our membership's pretty basic. I think it's like $35. You can also join, you can go to our memberships page and like, you can join Pope and Young and we get a part of that. And so you're joining both orgs at the same time. So we have some collaborative memberships where we're marketing some of these other NGOs that are popular and do good work. And we share the revenue on that. But it's like $35. The other thing is you don't have to be a member to use the Action Center. Anybody can jump on there and test drive the Action Center and use it and be an effective advocate. So the most important part of what we do in terms of, you know, individual hunter advocacy and engagement is free. What we need membership funds for, and where we're working with, you know, any kind of fundraising mechanism that we've got, where we're using those things, that's where we're going to turn those things around into, you know, I envision billboards outside of Seattle as people are driving in and out of Seattle that have pro hunting messages, and not just about we saved elk, but like the diverse faces of who hunters are and the different species that we engage in hunting, and that consumption's a key part of it. But building that messaging, that's where funding is going to go towards things like that. I do want to say this, since you guys are giving me the time here and I really appreciate it. This year, like I'd love for Howl to get $1 million in donations. That would be fantastic, right? More important than that, Howl is partnering with and really steering financial donations and investments towards Coloradans for Responsible Wildlife Management. Colorado is going to have probably this November on the ballot voted on by individual non-hunters, is going to be an opportunity to end mountain lion hunting and bobcat hunting in Colorado. Yeah. Wow. Mountain lion hunting is one of the most sustainable and regulated hunts there is in all of Colorado. It is incredibly regulated. It's wildly sustainable. It helps keep apex predator population in check healthily, to where, you know, 5 years from now, if this thing goes through, there will be another 100,000 mule deer a year coming off the landscape because of mountain lion kills, more than are already coming off the landscape. We as a community need to get behind this. And so the website to go find out how to support this issue and invest in the strategy that is going to be able to win this ballot initiative in November is called SaveTheHuntColorado.com. It's really easy. SaveTheHuntColorado.com. I'm challenging all of us to look at, what do we go into the field with? We go into the field with six, you know, gold tip arrows. Do you go in the field with a box with 20, you know, Creedmoor cartridges, a box of shells, 3-inch shells? Like, what do we go in the field with every day? What's the unit cost of that for a box of that or a dozen of that or whatever it is that we hunt with? That's the dollar equivalent that I think if every hunter in the U.S. commits $30, $50, $69, whatever it is, to SaveTheHuntColorado.com, we will win there and we will put a stop to a massive momentum machine that is the anti-hunting industry, and we'll draw the line there in Colorado and not have them roll that thing into other states, because that's what they'll do. That's where Howell's big battle is this year, is partnering with them and getting as much energy focused on SaveTheHuntColorado.com as possible.
We'll include a link to that in our show notes as well. That'll be at the top for everybody. I think that's my biggest concern, is that these, like you said, mm-hmm. the momentum from state to state, they're going to gain a following. They're going to gain legal footholds. And while state to state rulings in the court don't have quite the same precedent as interstate or federal rulings, it does give a precedent that is dangerous. And it does worry me about the sustainability of what we do and what we love. And frankly, our resources, because without us and our funding, it's not going to stay.
And because this is going to be a popular vote, it's not in the legislature, it's not in the commission, because it's a popular vote. Right. The messaging that needs to be developed and executed there to win that non-hunting public that's in Colorado, that we need to sculpt their perspective on this. It's the same messaging that we need to deploy everywhere into that non-hunter space. And so whether it's in Florida or in Seattle or in California, the messaging that works with that campaign it'll be something that's still in the toolkit. Like, we win on November 5th, we still have this messaging toolkit that can be deployed elsewhere, just with the pivot of a couple of things on the messaging, and it can go anywhere. And so that's going to be, it's not a one and done resource. It's not one and done for the anti-hunters, and it won't be one and done for us, because we'll be able to deploy those resources elsewhere as well. So as for Howell, website is either howell.org, howl.org, or howlforwildlife.org. Takes you to the same place. Cruise through, check out the Action Center, give it a look at the membership options, and everybody's welcome. Doesn't matter what they're hunting, where they're hunting, or what they're hunting with. We want everybody to become an advocate for themselves and their neighbor.
That's good stuff. Really, really good stuff.
Yeah, I appreciate
Mike,
it.
Mike, that's thank you guys. I love hearing kind of your evolution as a hunter and how that led into what might be considered by some as an extreme action for it. But I think overall I'm jealous of that. You know, I grew up with it all around me, and you get to remember your aha. You're like, you know, your exposure, you get to remember that whole thing. And I think that plays a huge part in your effort to keep it alive and keep it well. And so I appreciate that about you, man.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I have a lot of aha moments from the first trail cam picture to, you know, everything's an aha moment right now. So it's pretty cool. It's all still fresh and new.
Well, when we come and hunt your turkeys, awesome, your yard birds out there, we'll get to see an aha moment with why we love turkey so much. So
absolutely,
let's go ahead and get that on the calendar.
I need some education on that. You got it. Thanks, guys.
Yes, sir. Thank you.